Good day. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Ruth Riley. Ruth is a very well-known individual around the athletic community. She was a star basketball player at the University of Notre Dame and also in the WNBA, the Women's National Basketball Association. But she's gone beyond that and gone into working with some very interesting causes that are taking up a lot, if not all, of her time. Ruth Riley, With Respect. Ruth, how are you today?
I'm good. How
great.
Are you?
I'm fantastic. It's a great day. We may even get to a nice part of the year. The weather might be nice eventually. But I've got to ask you this. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Macy, Indiana. So in between South Bend and Indianapolis.
What kind of a community is that?
Very much a farming community. Moved around a little bit within that county, but mostly grew up on a farm somewhere.
What kind of farm?
In that area, it's usually corn. We didn't farm the land ourselves. It's just my mom raising my brother and sister and I, but we generally lived in a farmhouse and somebody else farmed the land.
The reason I ask that is because up in my neck of the woods in southwestern Michigan, we have a lot of farms which raise different kinds of crops or animals or whatever, but they also rent their property out, and so that's common to this area. So, where did you go to school?
I went to North Miami High School growing up, and then about an hour and 15 minutes north, I traveled up here to Notre Dame for my undergrad.
Now, you've got a brother and a sister. Tell me about them.
I have an older sister. She went to Notre Dame with me as well. She is kind of my counterpart when it comes to academic challenges growing up and sibling rivalries there. And then my brother is my basketball counterpart. And so he's the one that, a lot of heated one-on-one games over the years with my younger brother.
Well, with my younger brother and I, it was a matter of the fact, my mother once said that I must have been a saint to put up with my younger brother and to allow him to get to the age 12. Now, he would, of course, say what she told him, which was that he was a saint to put up with me until I went off to school. I went to a seminary. So after I left, then he became the star of the house. So my mother manipulated the two of us, and eventually we got to be good friends. But there was this period from about 5 to about 12 when there was a question as to whether either one of us were going to survive. But, as I say, now we are best friends. And how about you? Are you still close to your brother and sister?
Yeah, we're very close. Grateful to be back at Notre Dame for grad school right now. So I have the opportunity to be around my family a little bit more than kind of the dots in between undergrad and grad school took me around the world. So it's nice to be home. A couple of nieces and nephews that I get to spend some time with and have been really enjoying that.
When did you start being interested in basketball?
Well, I've always been tall. My mom encouraged us to be on our, obviously, first job was to get good grades, and beyond that, just to be active. And so I played a lot of different sports growing up. I was always the tallest girl in my grade, oftentimes the tallest student in my grade. and so, just really enjoyed volleyball, basketball, softball, track, just anything that kept me active.
You know, one time when I was in first or second grade, they had a school play of some sort, and I thought it was the biggest deal in the world because I was about 1/4 inch taller than any of the other boys, and so I got to play Uncle Sam and sang Yankee Doodle Dandy in front of this crowd. It was the scariest thing that I think I've ever done. But that's the advantage of being tall, right?
Well, there's a lot of advantages and a few disadvantages too, but it's definitely served me well.
Now, basketball, you gave something to it and it gave something to you. You played basketball in high school, right?
I did, yep.
And then you went on to the University of Notre Dame, 1996 or something like that?
Freshman year, 1997, graduated in 2001.
How did you happen to choose Notre Dame?
Oh, it's a confusing process, the recruiting process for college athletes, you know, a lot of different universities, some that I've honestly never heard of, offering me a scholarship to come and play at their school. But for me, Notre Dame was the only place that I knew that I wanted to go, and it just felt right. It was close to home, strong academics, opportunity to build a program and be a part of building a program on the athletic front, and my faith and sense of service and community were all very important to me, and it seemed like it had just the complete package that I was looking for.
Well, how tall were you when you started? You said you were the tallest girl in your class early on in high school and grammar school, but how tall were you when you went to the University of Notre Dame?
I was probably, 6'4", done growing for the most part by the time I got to college. And, you know, the great thing about being here at Notre Dame is that there are other tall athletes and other tall female athletes, whether it's volleyball or swimming or basketball. So I didn't feel like I was the only one in the crowd anymore. And so it kind of gave me a sense of confidence to see some other tall women around.
You know, that's interesting because people look at tall people and they think, oh, they must have all the confidence in the world because they're so tall, they stand out in a crowd, people notice them, therefore they must be really self-confident. Did you find that when you were growing up?
No, not at all. I mean, my personality was very introvert and shy, and so being the center of attention was not a comfortable place for me to be in, and I think as a, you know, being a female and standing out just made it even more uncomfortable because there just really weren't very many other tall girls around. Thankfully, my mom was constantly preaching for me to be proud of my height, to stand up straight, to take ownership and how God had created me, and it's a process, though, and I see it in a lot of young girls, too. You know, nobody wants to be different, especially in that middle school age. And so being taller than everyone else is definitely different.
Yeah, I would imagine. My daughter was also tall for her age, and she had this same thing. That is, she kept scrunching down because she didn't want to stand out until one day a friend of ours, a taller woman, looked at her and says, Carrie, I am so proud of you, how tall you are and how straight. And Lord, I couldn't have had the same effect with her, with my daughter, as this mutual friend of ours. And from that time on, she stood up straight. She was really happy with herself, still shy, but much more comfortable with her height. But at any rate, you began playing for, at that time, Division I, important, well-known football school. But was the basketball team that when you were there, when you started there, the women's basketball team?
They had reached the Final Four the year my senior year in high school. So the year that I knew that I was coming here was their first kind of breakout season into the rankings and the first Final Four in program history. And Coach Regatta had obviously been here for a long time building the program, but I think it was starting to get national attention as I was coming into college.
Today, one of the great rivalries in women's basketball is Notre Dame versus Connecticut. Was that the case back when you first started in 97?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that stems from both teams being powerhouses in the Big East Conference at the time and playing each other a few times during the regular season and conference tournament, and then at some point in the NCAA tournament. And so very, very big rivalry, I guess, over the years for us.
All right. All right. You're interested in academics. What kind of studies did you do? What really interested you when you were growing up?
Well, I knew I wanted to work with people. I thought at first I would be a doctor. And then when I got to school, I realized probably not going to take that path, but wanted to stay something where I was engaging with people, working with people. And so psychology and sociology were the two avenues that I chose here for undergrad.
What happened when you became, when you started to blend basketball at a university level with academics? Was that hard?
Yeah, the freshman year is definitely a challenge. Not only time management wise, your classes are harder. You're being demanded a lot more on the court. Not only in the hours that you spend practicing, but the level of competition is so much greater. And so it was a learning experience for me. I definitely spent most of my time either studying or playing basketball that first year.
Well, it fits with an introverted personality that you got this small world you can work with, the two pods of it, academics and athletics. What did you find that you put into and got out of on a psychological level with sports? And this, we're going to talk about a little bit about your WNBA work, but at this point, I want to look at the basketball court, and I see the players out there. I used to play basketball, much smaller college, a very small college, but I remember the thrill. I loved going out on the basketball court if there was no one around, and I was playing a game. It was the competition. What about you?
Well, I actually love the team dynamic of the sport I play. I think I wouldn't be a very good individual sport athlete. I love the ability to work with teams, lead teams, have a vision for what we're trying to accomplish, and try to figure out a way to get all my teammates to reach their potential in order for us to do it. But I also found on an individual level, I guess, what I learned early on was just to focus on my path. And I think it's very easy for young athletes to look at the strengths and weaknesses, or mostly strengths, of other players and just try to compare themselves to a certain player or handful of players. And, you know, I felt that there wasn't really anyone that I saw that was like me. And if I tried to be like someone else, I would lose probably what I brought that was best contributing factors to the team. So I learned early on to embrace what my strengths were.
You know, that's interesting because there's a carryover into my area, which is law. I remember running into many people, young people who came along and they joined a law firm or they became mentored by some famous or very skilled lawyer in whatever the area was. But I remember vividly where one fellow came in, and he was a young kid and he was a very bright young man. And he walked around with the fellow who was his senior partner in that firm, and he literally was like the shadow. He would mimic this to the point of even repeating his words in a dialogue, a three-part dialogue. He would pop up with his own, the boss's language and throw it at you just after the boss had said it. And he tried so much to be his boss that it reminded me of my mother's famous statement, is he became a chameleon on Scotch plaid. And it's hard to be a chameleon on Scotch plaid. And he was never, this young man was never successful at mimicking his mentor. In fact, left the practice of law and went off somewhere else. But at any rate, okay, eventually we're going to be talking about your professional basketball, but there's one more thing, and that is at the University of Notre Dame, your team, your last year, went on to something special, and what was that?
We were able to win a national championship my senior year, and You know, it's really with a storybook season, a lot of firsts that year, first sellout crowd for our program, and then at the Joy Center, first number one ranking for our program, and then obviously the first national championship. And for me as an athlete, just very blessed to walk off the court having the opportunity to represent a university that I love, and having my last game that I'll ever play in a Notre Dame jersey be one to win a championship. So I realize that not many athletes get that, and just truly grateful for what we were able to accomplish here.
It's a fantastic thing to have it all come together. And whatever your skill, I was a pitcher in baseball, and when I went out of the court, on the field rather, the whole world collapsed, and I was the focal point of my own action. And I went ahead, and I loved every minute of what I was doing. Every minute. It felt so good that if I could contribute, if I could strike somebody out in that at a crucial time, you explode with satisfaction, I think.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's just a a passion for why you play the game and you love the game, and you're able to just be in the moment. And, whatever other life challenges you have kind of disappear for that time period that you're out there on the court.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Ruth Riley, an all-star, all-American basketball player for the University of Notre Dame, number one. We've been talking about that. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about her briefly about her time with the Women's National Basketball Association. But then we're going to be talking about what she's been doing since her career in basketball, actively in basketball, came to an end. This is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Ruth Riley, the All-American player for Notre Dame in their national championships win in 2001, and a great player and a person who also loved academics. That was the primary thing that she looked at, got from her mother, that's what life and education was supposed to be about, and sports came second. This is John Smetanka with Respect. So, Ruth, after graduation, after winning the national championship, you went on to play professional basketball. And I'm not sure that everybody knows about what the Women's National Basketball Association is, or how it got started, and what it's doing now. But take a minute and tell us what it was like, what it does. What is the Women's National Basketball Association?
What is the best women's professional basketball league in the world? It's sister to the NBA, and under the umbrella of the NBA family, you have the D League, the WNBA, the NBA. They're all kind of considered one big family when it comes to professional basketball here in the United States. And graduating in 1997 from high school, I was the first class going into college that knew that there was an opportunity to play professional basketball when I graduated. The league started that summer of 1997, and so for the longest time, women had to play overseas. There was no true professional opportunity here in the U.S., and went throughout college, was able to get drafted to Miami 5th, and just had the opportunity to play at home and abroad for the next 13 years.
That's a long time. That means put together with your high school and your college, that's got to be 21 years of devotion to a particular sport. And it's a lot of bruising and a lot of exercise and a lot of all the stuff, the stressors that go into it. How did you put up with that? I mean, was it all joy and happiness when you went out there?
Well, it's a sport that I obviously loved playing, but training isn't always joyful. No, I mean, you do, as an athlete and a competitive athlete, you train your body in a way that's going to help you perform to the best of your ability, and that's not always going to be in the comfort zone. But you definitely push yourself to get better, add different skill sets, which takes a lot of repetition outside of practice. And just, you know, even as throughout my career, training has advanced in so many ways with the addition of technology and research. And so I saw, you know, able to train smarter and just more efficiently throughout my career.
How many teams are there in the National Women's National Basketball Association now?
There are 12 teams. We're actually heading into our 20th anniversary season this summer. And so, you know, exciting times now. These young girls who pick up a basketball at a very early age have the luxury of growing up their entire lives thinking that there's an opportunity to play, where for me, you know, the Olympics was my dream because I didn't know that there was going to be an opportunity to play in the WNBA.
And you also did play in the Olympics, didn't you?
I did. I'm very fortunate to represent my country in the 2004 Olympics over in Athens, and, you know, blessed to have that dream come true.
How did we do in that Olympics?
We won the gold. Our women's team has won since the 96 Olympics, consecutively since the Atlanta Olympics, the gold, and so has been a dominant powerhouse in the global scale, but there's definitely some tough competition that I'm sure we'll face this summer as it's another Olympic year.
Will you be playing on the trying out or playing with the Olympics team this year?
No, not after 2004. We have so many young players. You think about the size of our country and the talent that we have. It's a tough pool to choose 12 from.
Well, let's stop now and circle around to what you're doing, not just in basketball, but with basketball. And you've taken on some causes that you've had some sponsorship by the WNBA, NBA, but also these are things which interest you. Tell us about that.
Well, I've always been conscious of the platform that I have as an athlete, recognizing young boys and girls look up to us, and, you know, we've tried to be a role model within my community, within my state. But once I started playing professionally, that just got extended to a more global scale as the NBA asked me to represent them for a World AIDS event in Kenya in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And so since immediately returning from that, the United Nations Foundation asked me to be a founding spokesperson with their malaria campaign, Nothing But Nets. And, you know, we provide these bed nets for children to sleep under. Surprisingly, malaria is a leading killer of children throughout Africa under the age of 5. And so something we obviously don't have to deal with or think about here, but completely preventable and a very simple solution of a $10 bed net. And so it's just been amazing to see how I can leverage my platform from basketball to do something positive in the world and global health and women's empowerment, and also, you know, on a global scale and a national scale.
Well, you know, I'm hearing a person talking who's now an outreach person who talks to groups, and we're going to talk about how you deal with young people around the world. But this is not the same person who was shy, tall. You want to say, I think you used the word gawky or something like that. When you're in high school, you seem to have changed.
Yeah, I think that the 4 years in college really helped me grow and just be comfortable in my own skin. And like I said, being around other tall female athletes, the sport itself, I think, teaches so many positive character traits, whether it's overcoming adversity or building confidence and working well with others, communication skills. And so just having all that kind of taught over the 4 years that I was at Notre Dame, and I think success kind of throws you in the spotlight. And so as that spotlight grew, I, you know, challenged myself to think about how I wanted to use that. And I had to come out of my comfort zone a little bit to be able to use that in a positive way.
So what do? You go out and you just work with people in office buildings in Nairobi or Kenya or wherever. Or is it more outreach than that?
It's pretty organized by, different organizations. So it's either HIV prevention, could be malaria prevention, could be building communities, sustainability. I do some work when it comes to women's empowerment. I've traveled with our State Department to places like Saudi Arabia or the Congo, and just having the opportunity to speak specifically to women who might not have the opportunity to play sports as I do, but look up to me as a role model. And I started a nonprofit in South Africa that uses sport as a platform to create behavior change in the youth, and hopefully reducing the HIV prevalence rate in that area.
Is that one on your own that you started, or that's sponsored by the organizations you work for otherwise?
That one is one that I started with two of my friends, two other co-founders, and so a very small nonprofit called Inspire Transformation. And you know, so I've worked kind of on every level, very small grassroots, which is my own national campaign here in the United States, which is No Kid Hungry, and then global campaign like the UN Foundation and the work I do with the State Department and the NBA.
As I recall, didn't you testify in front of Congress at some point?
Yeah, the first time I've done that, I had the opportunity to give my testimony as a success story, really, of why our nutrition programs are needed, especially free reduced lunch programs. And, you know, my mom did everything she could to provide for my sister and my brother and I, but that didn't mean there was always enough money. And so we needed a little assistance. And so just sharing my story, how that helped me, whether it was to focus in school or to help me have the energy I needed to compete on the basketball court, and how that had changed the trajectory of my life.
That the contributions get made after contributions are given. That is, you contribute to what you're to other people, but you were given contributions by others. And you talk, you know, a bit about your mom, and now you talk about the little aid that you received, assistance that she received in raising the two of you. But who else in your life do you think, besides your mom, was probably the greatest influence in getting you to where you're at?
I would say Coach McGraw. I mean, my coach here at the University of Notre Dame was definitely one of the most influential figures in my life, and continues to be a great friend and mentor to me now. I've been blessed to have a lot of different mentors, whether it be in business or in basketball or in the nonprofit space, and I just really believe in not only the value of having mentorship in your life, but then passing that on to the next generation and finding those individuals that you can really invest in as well.
You talk about going to Saudi Arabia, and I remember hearing about that, and that was a fascinating event because you're talking about going to a country that, at least until recently, did not provide the same kind of opportunities for women to participate in sports that the rest of the world has. Is that right?
Well, and they still don't. There's still a lot of barriers for female athletes to overcome, but the new king did pass a law for the first time instituting physical education in the school system. And so you find that Saudi Arabia is a country where the women have the second highest diabetes rate in the world because there's just nowhere for them to work out. They don't even have the option to go to a gym to work out outside to take care of their bodies. And so, you know, this is a one step of progress in the right direction. I mean, there's still a lot of steps that need to be taken, but, you know, trying to just learn, honestly, I go on those trips to get a better idea of what the reality is for those women, to inspire them as much as I can and to come back and tell their stories.
Do you have any, how do they react to this? I mean, you know, you're 6'4", 6'5", and you come into a community and you play in basket, get in basketball clothes and you go out on the court and you got sneakers on and you're ready to go. And what are you faced with when you're in Saudi Arabia? Are you faced with young girls or women going out in their basketball clothes and getting ready to start dribbling and shooting?
Well, first of all, they're not allowed to go out anywhere to play basketball. The sport has to be in a secluded area where men can't watch them play. But what I found with these girls is they're just so excited to learn and so excited to have somebody come from the outside who's respectful of their culture, who's not judgmental, who wants to help and teach them and encourage them and to help them, you know, just share the passion of the sport. And so I found a lot of energy and a lot of just excitement around me being there.
You know, I remember you talking someplace or other about the fact that the people you deal with, and we'll just talk about Saudi Arabia for a minute, but I'm going to ask you to expand it after we take a break. But I want to talk when we get back about the receptiveness, not only the women in basketball in Saudi Arabia, but the other people that you've met around the world. Are they receptive? Are they intelligent? Or do they show spirit and all that? We're going to get back to that in a minute, but we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Ruth Riley, former All-American center for the University of Notre Dame's women's basketball team that won the national championship in 2001, and a star also in the Women's National Basketball Association for a number of years, and recently retired. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Ruth Riley, a basketball player, quite famous, very skilled, many records to her credit. But what we've been focusing on now is not just her creation, turning herself from a shy person who happened to be tall, but into a figure of leadership. And Ruth, I want to carry it on from there. The young women that you run across in all the places around the world that you work now, what are they like? I mean, I know what American women are like, and they're a wide mixture, and they're some very athletic and some not, and whatnot. What were they like, the people that you deal with?
Well, I would say it obviously varies according to the location that you're traveling to, but often you find a lot of similarities in the developing world and just how women are viewed, how young girls are viewed, and the challenges they face just to get a simple education, to have ownership over their bodies, to have the opportunity of employment and to set goals and visions for their lives. And so when I travel there, I mean, I try to learn as much as I can about the reality of their lives to see where I can inspire them to maybe take that next step forward or be a part of progress in their countries.
Now, you and one statement that I read that you had made, you emphasized something which I was surprised at? No, I wasn't surprised at, but I was happy to see it. And that is, you talked about the intelligence of the women, the young women that you ran across. They may have been in different clothes, but you found them very intelligent and receptive. Tell me about that.
Well, a common thread throughout the world that I've traveled to, and women are ones that are going to invest back in their communities. They're always thinking of how they can, whether you're giving them microfinance loans or whether you're providing them opportunities for education, they're going to capitalize on that so much more and reinvest into their communities, build them up, be a part of the solution. And you see that as a lot of the global sustainable development goals are focused around young girls and women, because they are the key to how we're going to take a step forward in making this world a better place.
Why? Why? What's the matter with the guys? I mean, what's the, you know, I know they've been, that we have been running this place for a long time, but why women now at this point in history?
Well, I think part of it is a personality trait. looking out as women. They're nurturers. They're going to be community builders. They're thinking they've been the ones that have taken care of their homes and their communities for so long. But if you empower them with knowledge, or empower them with resources, or empower them with the money to add to that, I think that's where you're going to see the benefit of a lot of these kind of grassroots programs that have proven this.
Now, one of the surprises for me about when I got to know people from South America and Central America was that, well, it's to some people, and maybe even me when I started off, oh, anything below the Rio Grande is just all homogenized, the same Hispanic, and they're all the same. Well, as I got to study it, I found that each of those countries has a different character, a different history, perhaps even a different language or accent, different vocabulary, different customs, and all of this is, it's just this explosion of diversity that I learned about. And I would imagine that you have found, I think you just described it earlier, some of the same things with perhaps the differences between women in Saudi Arabia and Africa. Tell me about that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are cultural differences, dictating the roles of women, the opportunities for them, what they should look like, how they should act, even whether they can decide who they're going to marry or how long they can go to school. I mean, those, so many differences that you'll find. But I think a common theme that I found in being raised by a very strong, independent woman is just the strength, the underlying strength of some of the mothers and the girls that I met. That is a common thread that is woven throughout the different countries that I've traveled to.
Well, the idea of microloans, which is something that you discussed, you use that phrase. And I'm not sure that everybody understands what a microloan is and where it came from, but it is a project which was revolutionary in the way we finance people and invention and ingenuity around the world. What about that? What is microloaning?
Well, it's expanded a lot since I first learned about it in 2006, and now especially with the connectivity of the internet and the opportunity for investing honestly in that. But I've seen it in communities in Mali, traveling to this very rural area, and women get together once a week. They pool their money together. They provide microloans to each other. There's accountability, giving the opportunity to invest in a crop or to invest in a very small business, but usually agriculturally based, or it could be a sewing or beadery or whatever it is, and then they're accountable to that group. And it's amazing to see the profit, how they're able to take care of just small amounts of money and turn a profit and a revenue and increase that and magnify that, take care of their families and their communities.
The first time I heard about this, there was an individual in India, I believe, who had come up with the idea of this microloaning. And I remember seeing these statistics, which were phenomenal. Money was being given out in very small doses to very small projects. And I say small because they were very local, in a village or whatever. And they talked about the profit was enough to pay back the loans. These are not just gift programs. They're not grant programs that no one has a responsibility to pay back, because we've seen that with America has seen that with a lot of loans to countries or companies that take the money and go bankrupt, or in the case of countries, divert it to the pockets of the government. But in these microloans, these folks, and I'm going to say that many of them are women, if not all, they actually give back, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're structured in a way where there's an expectation for them to be paid back. And honestly, they're held accountable oftentimes by their other women in their community. And so there's a sense of responsibility to your community. And women are just capitalizing on the opportunity that's never been given to them before, and you've seen how they've been able to be good stewards of that.
Well, one of the things that When I came along, I have a daughter, and she is now beyond college and in the workforce. But when she was growing up, it was after Title IX. We're gonna talk a little bit about Title IX now. But what I used to get angry about is I would see the boys' sports in high school or even grammar school take 90% of the oxygen out of the air. And this was, unfortunately, in my view, something which young girls shared in. I mean, they would come out to the boys' basketball game, but they wouldn't come out to the girls' basketball game. And as a father of a girl who was a good athlete, I was hurt by that. And I've found out that there's many men that I know who are season ticket holders to Notre Dame women's basketball, and we talk about why we're there. And I had a group of 8 or 9 men standing out in the lobby during a halftime of a game, and I asked them, "Hey, how many of you have daughters?" Everybody raised their hand. "How many of you think that your daughters got an unfair shake in when they were athletes or whatever in high school?" Everybody raised their hand. And I think that I've struck on one common denominator in that regard. This is after Title IX, many years after Title IX. There's a psychological, cultural thing going on here that I'm puzzled by. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have seen tremendous progress even throughout my career. You know, now the Joy Center is filled. I mean, you could almost sell out season tickets for the entire arena. And, you know, when I was a freshman, that wasn't the case. And so I think building something, Notre Dame has been able to build something here for our women's program that's truly special. But I do think that we still have a lot of progress that needs to be made, and needs to be made not only women supporting women, but also just in the sports world. I mean, it's still very male-dominant space, and you look at ESPN and how they portray women's sports and just the lack of visibility that the WNBA and other women's professional sports receive. Still a long road to go in that respect.
One of the things that my brother sent me a note on the other day, and that is that he looked at the attendance for Arizona State University playing, I think it was Southern Cal, a real strong, you know, inter-school rivalry in the Pac-12. And one would think, because Arizona State has got is a high ranking and they're playing their one of their arch rivals, that you would have, and this is a women's basketball game, and the attendance was 880 people. I have looked on television at games all over in women's sports, and if you see 300, 400, 1,000, 1,000 is a huge number in some of these places. It hasn't caught on yet. Whereas in the men's sports, again, it's a lot of people show up, a lot of students show up. It's a younger audience. Even in Notre Dame, it's a younger audience, but how do we go about changing that, Ruth? I mean, I've had these season tickets. My friends and I have had these season tickets for years. We love the Notre Dame women's basketball, and not only Notre Dame. Of course, the teams that come to play. And you're right. They have almost today many, many sellouts every year, 9,100 and some odd people at the Joyce Center. How do we go about changing that for our daughters and our granddaughters?
Well, I think there's multiple factors there. I mean, some of the schools, I think what Notre Dame has done that's led to success is, A, they're good, right? They're, you know, in success, people are going to come and support and want to be a part of that. Sustained success is what we've seen here at Notre Dame that's led to, I think, our ticket sales being so high. Also an investment in marketing. And a lot of times I question, you know, how women's sports is being marketed. Is it even being marketed at some of these schools in a way that, you know, is attracting or would potentially attract the community to come out. And I argue the money probably isn't the same when you talk about marketing the men's and women's teams. And it is a mindset of society, too, to say, you know, to value, you got to find the customer base that is going to value women's sports and connect with them.
Well, if Notre Dame is any model for that, I mean, they have increased since before you came. They may have been before Muffet McGraw got there. Maybe the attendance was just as low as ASU and Southern Cal. But the point is, it can be done. It can be done if people put their minds to it and if there is a receptive audience.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We've shown that here. I mean, Coach McGraw's been here 29 years, so there's not too many years that she has not been coaching here at Notre Dame. But mm-hmm. I would say it's the investment in marketing. I saw a huge benefit of that while I was here, and especially after I was here. And just now there's so many more innovative ways and creative ways of connecting with communities. But it has to be a priority. And other schools have to prioritize and put money in. A lot of times marketing people don't want to invest in that. And so you have to, I guess, prioritize your women's sports, make that investment, and I think you're going to see a return on it.
We're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, I'm going to talk more about what the both the work that she is doing, that Ruthie is doing overseas, but also here in the United States. What is the payback to society from this outreach that she and the WNBA and the NBA and her own organization are doing? We're going to take a break right now. This is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Ruth Riley, an All-American basketball player at the University of Notre Dame, an All-Star for the Women's National Basketball Association and her career with that organization. And we're going to now pass on to what's the end result. As I say, this is John Smetanka on With Respect. Ruth, what is the payback? Let's just talk about the United States for a minute. We've had Title IX, so we have some government rules that there must be some equality in opportunity for both men and women in athletics and other areas. All right. However, we know from just the attendance records, it hasn't quite come up to equality there, but what is the payback for developing in women, young women, as coming into adulthood? What is the payback for athletics, from athletics to their future lives? Tell me, what do they get out of it? Why is it going to be better if we have athletics, women involved, equality, opportunity? What else?
Well, a few things come to mind. The first is the study that's been done where I think 80% of female C-suite executives all played sports growing up. So uh-huh. There's something about sports that teaches leadership, that teaches setting goals and overcoming adversity, working with others. There's something within the competition and the activity of sport itself that teaches these intrinsic and tangible values and characteristics. But I also would point to the fact that look at the trends that our world is going, and it's going in a negative direction when it comes to physical education being taken out of schools and activities, and the obesity rates are so much higher at a younger age. And I think that sport, obviously, the programs like our junior NBA, junior WNBA program are going to be even more important now that we've seen this kind of trend going in a negative direction.
Well, Michelle Obama has taken on as her personal crusade the reduction of obesity, especially in children. And it's had fits and starts, there's some criticism of it, but I think that it's not the methods that maybe are critical at some point, criticizable at some point, but the goal of getting kids out of the couches in front of, as I saw one night with a friend's child, 15-year-old kid, sitting in front of a television. He had his earphones on for his music. He had the television on. He had a computer on his lap, and he was texting all at the same time. And you know what? His parents, who are both professionals, came to him and said, "Billy, can I get you a sandwich?" And he just let them. He's, "Well, you can fix me whatever." And I thought, get up off your doofus and get it yourself, kid. But I see, unfortunately, too much of that. And frankly, not just women. Whether it's obesity directly or lack of physical exercise, television, internets are killing us. I'm sorry, that was them ranting.
It's absolutely true, but of course it's across the board. There's no gender specific target when it comes to our youth, I don't think, and it's more visibility on a high level for young girls to think, okay, I can dream big. I can dream, whether it's basketball or some other profession, that women can do the same thing that men can do. So I think it's A, giving them kind of a vision, inspiration for that, and then B, creating kind of grassroots platforms that the NBA is launching across the United States and honestly globally throughout the world, of these junior NBA programs where you're connected to some of your favorite players, you're given the opportunity to participate in a sport that's, at a different skill level where you feel like you can just enjoy playing the sport of basketball. And then we have a fit campaign as well that's not only talking about the skills of basketball, but just the activities that you could do with or without a ball to stay active.
I teach over in Europe every year, and I've been in the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republics. And some years ago, I was up in a little town called Kosice. I say little town, a city called Kosice in Slovakia. And as I was walking around one day, I saw a huge big billboard. And in fact, I saw several billboards with the same pictures on it around town. And they were of basketball, women basketball players. And I thought, holy mackerel, they're here too? And you talked about it just now, that young women can go over and play in Europe as well as they can play in the United States, maybe. What's the difference between the two?
Well, there's a few small differences in just the way the game is played. I mean, most of the rules are the same, but you find that the European game is much more skilled. The U.S. game is probably faster and more physical. The European game, especially in my position, in the post position, you can find that a lot of our European bigs can dribble, can shoot, can have a more complete skill set, because that's just encouraged to develop over there, where you're kind of siloed here growing up in the United States. But I find that's changing now. And so there's difference, but it has been truly amazing where the sport has taken me throughout Europe, and played in South Korea and China as well, and the opportunity to just kind of see the world, experience the world, and play a sport that I love.
Wow. You know, if I could have played professional baseball, if I hadn't done other things, I always wondered what it would have been like to play in the big stadiums and to go around and, you know, around the world, and just to, you know, be a part, have my athletics turn me into a citizen of the world, at least, you know, to see what it's like. But you did that, so I'm envious. What? Tell me about it. What internally now? I'm not talking about exactly what you've done, you know, where you've gone. What is it like? Why are you different now than you were when you went into, let's say, when you left Notre Dame?
I would just say, I mean, living in a country for 3 to 6 months, really immersed in a different culture, gives you a unique perspective. It changes your paradigm of the world, and I think it's helped me kind of see the world and be more accepting of our differences, and understanding and seek to understand, you know, people that cross my path now, because I've seen how different this world is. I mean, I grew up in a very, very rural area where there was a complete lack of diversity. And so basketball has taken me to the opposite end of that spectrum. And I appreciate that.
So what are you going to do now? You've now moved to the ambassador level, but you've also dabbled, it sounds like, with some of your own, you and two partners, starting a program in South Africa. Is that with a future for Ruth Riley or something else? You're still working for a degree, aren't you?
So I finished my executive MBA back here at Notre Dame in May. So then it's trying to figure out which avenue to take, whether I stay within sports, the business of sports, or I go more the global health, women's empowerment route. Equally passionate about both, and so kind of pursuing both avenues right now.
One of the things that I was struck by going to various teams that I watch, various teams that I like the best baseball team in the world, I hope you understand this, is the Chicago White Sox. I just want you to, you know, get just lay it out. And my daughter claims that I was the one who turned her into a Cubs fan by taking her to Wrigley Field one time when she was 6 or 7 years old with an office trip. I claim that I didn't do that, but unfortunately she got it fixed that she loves that little stadium and the people who go there and the team that plays there. And unfortunately I was raised on the south side of Chicago, and we don't quite have the same feelings about the Cubs that she does now. So this is a big fight within our family. But one of the things that was fascinating to me, and I think I've gotten at it from what you've been talking about, is in the sports, whether it's in college or the NBA, WNBA, there is a family aspect to this, that there's a unity in the people who are playing the game or ministering the game or taking tickets to the game, that's really special. It is a team, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I would say that not only is there unity in that, but I think that it's a unique platform. I would argue that probably sports and music are too, that really transcend all barriers. And so, I mean, you roll a basketball regardless of what country you're in, and the ball itself doesn't know if you're male or female, what age you are, what race you are, what your social economic status is. I mean, it's a way where you can bring people together, unite people, teach them, use as a platform in a very meaningful way. And there's not too many things that unifies, I feel like, our world like sports and probably music does.
Ruth Riley, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. We could be talking about this for another 2 hours, but I thank you for your time, and I wish you well in whatever you choose to do to emphasize in your life. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me on the show, John.
The name of our program is With Respect, and we're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And until next time, remember our mantra: if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.